everyone. My name is Evelyn Mills-Hawley. I'm a guardian to speaker. You know, my old friend Jim used to say, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad I know that today. It explains a lot, and that's kind of how I feel. It explains a lot about my life. And I came here and got sober April 10th of 1994, and my home group is the Tuesday Night Women's Amity Group. I'd like to invite all the women here to come for a great meeting. To share, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, what it was like is that, you know, I just grew up in a, you know, normal family. What's normal? I don't know. I thought it was normal. I had great parents, a couple of brothers, never got in too much trouble, never really started getting, active in, you know, alcohol until I got in my 20s. You know, and I'm sure like a lot of people, for me, it was just about going out and having a good time. I did some of that in high school, but it was the weekend stuff, and really never had to pay any consequences behind it, you know. I'm really going to tell you my age right here, because back in the day, you know, when we used to cruise around and drive and drink, you know, really pretty much the worst the cops would do you is just like pour out your liquor and make you go home, you know. That's what it was like then, so... you know, like I said, no consequences. When I got into my 20s, I mean, I don't know what happened. I did more and more and more, and I also got involved in some things that I'll just call problems other than alcohol. And if you want to know what that means, there's a pamphlet on it, problems other than alcohol. You know, and I practiced that for many, many years, and I was a functional alcoholic for many, many years. Once again, you know, no consequences behind my drinking and the things that I was doing. And finally, after years and years and years, I finally, you know, it kind of surfaced at work. And I worked at a job where I needed to know contracts and be able to apply those contracts to insurance policies and patients. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing one day. I just went, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And then I didn't know what I was doing the next day after that. And I got really scared. And I took some time off work. And, you know, the answer to me was to go see a therapist. And I just thought that therapist was just going to get me all well, give me some magic pill or something, you know, and I was going to be well. Well, you know, first thing she told me was that I needed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and of course I wasn't going to do that. You know, that was just not going to happen. I don't know what I thought about AA, but I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And over the next few months, you know, I continued that downward spiral. And got to the point that I couldn't even go out of my house. I couldn't do basic self-care like take a shower, brush my teeth even, or eat anything like that. It was just like, boy, I find myself holed up in my place. And I don't know, you know, the therapist just kind of finally told me, you need to go because you're not taking suggestions. You're not doing what I'm telling you to do. And I can remember getting on my knees one night and being in the darkest, blackest place I've ever been in my life. And I know today that that was absolute helplessness and hopelessness. And I got on my knees and I just prayed. You know, the only thing that I knew to pray to help, you know. And the next morning I got up and I called the place and I checked myself in. And so, you know, I went in there and I detoxed. And you know, they do all these groups with you with all these counselors and, you know, your history and your origin and all these sort of stuff. But they also told me that when I got out, I needed to go to AA. So, you know, I still didn't really like that. But, you know, they gave us these little cards. You know, you've seen them. You put them in the basket. And so I got one of those little cards, so I kind of had to go to AA. And, you know, I have to tell you that the very first meeting that I walked into was a Nooners meeting at the Alana Club, and I saw a whole bunch of people in there I knew, you know, from out there. And they were all laughing it up and having a great time. I mean, really, and carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can remember that, you know, what I went away with was, you know, that these people were sober, gave me hope, they were having a great time. This wasn't like misery, to be in recovery, to be sober. And I remember that reading, you know, that this chapter that said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And, you know, the last one, you know, the three-part net ideas. And so that gave me hope. And they told me to keep coming back. And so I kept going back. And then, you know, I heard all the old-timers talk about Reed's book. And they told me to get a sponsor. And so I did that. And they told me to look around the room and listen to the women who were sharing and pick out somebody that had what I wanted. And so I did. You know, I listened a lot. And so I got hooked up with a sponsor. And I'm really, really grateful for the very first sponsor I ever had, you know, because I did get busy right away working the steps. And, you know, I have to tell you that one of the things she taught me right from the get and I didn't really like was to own my own stuff. You know, I mean, I used to call her on the phone, be yada, 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 yada. You know, and she'd say, well, what was your part in all this? I'd say, oh, I didn't have a part in all this. You know, they're out there doing all this to me. You know, and I didn't get away with it. You know? And that's part of the stuff that you figure out when you start working steps, you know, and you start taking ownership for my behavior. You know, my behavior started with the stinking thinking going on up here. You know, it's sick, sick. And so, you know, that sponsor remained my sponsor for my first 6.5 years. Worked the steps, went to meetings, got into service. And, you know, after I had about 4 years and thought that I somewhat knew what was going on here, I started sponsoring women. And, you know, unfortunately, that first sponsor, when I had 6.5 years, decided to go back out, and she hasn't come back since. Pray that she does one of these days. It was, you know, a very sad and devastating experience for me. I was angry, and then shortly after that, some of the 4 or 5 women that, you know, we were just kind of did things together and went to meetings together and things like that, they all went out too. So it was like, I was just by myself. And, you know, I have to tell you that I never took the time to get to know a whole lot of other people during that time. And, you know, I remember being so sad and not even feeling like, you know, I knew anybody in the meetings anymore. My boyfriend told me, just go to the meeting and just walk up and say hello to somebody. Why don't you do that? Why don't you try that? You know, so I did, you know, and started making friends all over again and, you know, feeling a lot better. That was a hard thing for me to work through. And I remember he told me, now you know what it feels like, you know, what all your friends and your family felt like when you were continuing to go out there and get drunk, you know, how they worried and, you know, all that with you. So, you know, I have to tell you that, you know, I've been through a lot of experiences sober. I've been around a few days. And not everything's been pleasant, and not everything has been easy to work through. But, you know, having a sponsor and having lots and lots of friends around here and women and some men that I could count on, you know, have helped me through some difficult times because they've experienced those same things, you know, and they were able, you know, I know that I had 4.5 years when my dad passed away. He was like my best bud ever, and that was difficult. You know, there were people around here who experienced the loss of their folks and were able to kind of help me through that, and that's what I found here. You know, I continue to go to meetings. One of the biggest reasons I continue to go to meetings is because I have lots of friends now. And the other thing is because I have a fear of relapse, you know. I know people that have been around and quit going to meetings, and that's what they always tell you when they come back, you know, I quit going to meetings. And, you know, I think that for me, I really, and probably many of us do, but I can only speak for myself, I believe deep down inside that I'm an alcoholic, as the big book talks about. You know, I'm eligible for any reason, any time, through sadness, through happiness, whatever. You know, I'm eligible to go out there and drink again. I used to hear people say, you know, it's not an option for me. Well, you know, it is for me. And I continue to go to meetings because I want to stay sober. I don't want to get drunk again, and I don't want to have to get sober again. You know, it's hard. I can remember, you know, that first year, you know, and coming to those meetings and getting that 30-day shift, the 60-day, the 90-day, and, you know, I mean, I kept coming back, and I'd pack those chips around with me in my pockets all the time, you know. And, you know, and then I got a year, and that was awesome. And I think I finally started believing in myself that I could stay sober if I could just keep doing this deal, you know. So that's why I keep doing this deal. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what it's done for me. And, you know, like I said, I've been through some really difficult things here. Some of my hardest times have been the last 4 years here, you know, with family issues and going to court and just these sick, insane family of mine, you know. But I had to step away from it, and it's been painful, very painful. Probably the most painful thing I've been through. But, you know, I just keep going to meetings, and I keep talking to women, and keep doing the deal, just putting one foot in front of the other. And there's lots of times that I don't want to put one foot in front of the other, but, you know, another thing that I got here was the gift of a belief in a power greater than me, you know. And I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I read the book sometimes from the beginning to the end, the beginning of the end, and I still just can't even believe, you know, what Bill and Bob did. You know, the first part of the book when it tells the story of them. You know, I mean, isn't that amazing? Still today, all these years later, those stories and how they started this whole deal. You know, I'm really grateful. And, I feel like if I talk anymore, I'm probably going to be showing just, you know, my ego or whatever. So I'm going to go ahead and leave you all with that. I do want to tell you, I'm really glad to see everybody here tonight. And I'm really glad to see a lot of old friends I haven't seen in a long, long time. So it was really nice to come in and see your faces tonight. It made me feel a lot more comfortable. So thank you.
Thank you very much. You were fabulous. Let's take a short break. So dig into the cookies, and those who smoke, have one out there for us. California.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jeanette. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. You know, it's really an honor to be asked to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a program that saved my life. And I'm very thankful to be useful in some way. And you know, when I do what I know to do, and that's to ask God to help me to share who I am and to tell the truth. And I was joking with some friends before the meeting. I said, I heard a fantastic speaker on TV this morning, and I think I'll just share her story. Because it sounded really good. And so, but it's my story, and it's the one I've got. And I started drinking when I was 17. I didn't have a lot of exposure to alcohol. I grew up in a kind of commune, you know, nobody smoked, drank, cussed, everybody worked together for the good of the community. It was very holistic, you know, we canned our own applesauce and had community gardens, and very carefree as a child, except that, you know, like we had the one house on this community where cleanliness is next to godliness, you know, that was true trash quality. And so it was very embarrassing as a kid, you know, they keep telling you this, but you can't have your friends over because of the state of the house. you know. So I always felt different on the inside than I knew I was supposed to look on the outside. You know, we lived there for quite a while, and, you know, we finally moved off of that little community and moved a couple miles down the road. We still went to the little two-room schoolhouse, you know, where grades 1 through 6 were in this room and 7 through 8 were in the other. And, you know, it was a great way to grow up as a kid. We had horses, we rode to school and tied them up in the fields, you know, in South Colorado. It was like, you know, it's just how it was. It seemed pretty normal. It didn't seem real special or unique, but I spent a lot of time, like, you know, being a kid, building forts and catching mud puppies, little water dogs, and building dams and, you know, exploring. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, but life was still kind of weird over here at home, and I was looking for that thing that was going to make me okay. And when I was, about 17, I discovered alcohol. And I was living with my grandparents up by Chico, and my aunt, who worked at a bar, took her cute little 17-year-old niece there after hours. And, you know, they made some drinks, and I thought it tasted just nasty. I mean, why would you give someone a black Russian when they haven't drank? You give them something sweet, like, you know. And, but I remember I must have got a pretty good buzz, because I was sitting there at the, at the bar on the bar stool, licking strawberries out of a glass, trying to be sexy. And so right away, alcohol did that thing for me that it does for many of us, and it was not often I got a chance to drink, but I drank every chance I could. And the first time I got drunk with my peers, it was magic. It was pure magic. It took me from feeling alone and hundreds of miles away from my family, which I was, to feeling, well, part of the universe. I mean, it opened me right up, and I was enough of everything, and I was more than plenty, and it was just magical. It was nothing short of fabulous. And, you know, like a week later or a few days later, when the guy I was interested in hadn't called me, and I'm again feeling alone and separate and sad, I know that if I can get something to drink, I will be okay. And I think that's what makes me an alcoholic. From the very beginning, I made the connection that alcohol does something for me. It fixes me in a way that nothing I have found to date does. And I loved it. I found a way to get something to drink that night. And I remember walking back to my grandparents' home. I was living with them. And I'm looking up at the stars, and I'm thinking how I don't need anybody. I'm enough just as I am. And that feeling of well-being and being good in my skin was all over me. And I just loved it. Moved back to Colorado, be with my family there, and ended up being a ward of the state for a time. And I didn't have a lot of opportunity to drink, but I drank every chance I could. All of those events in my childhood, all of that upheaval, whatever it was, you know, that's not what makes me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is that aha, this is the solution to my problems. When I drink, I'm okay. You know, it fixes me. And then I seek that feeling. And I look for it long after that sense of ease and comfort has passed. And it's leaving me feeling, well, alone and isolated. And like I'm behind a glass. I'm in a room full of people, but I'm not connected. And that didn't happen right away. I had a lot of fun with alcohol. I went places, I did things, there were no holds barred. I just had a good time, and I love to have fun, and I love to have fun today. And not drinking hasn't stopped me from accomplishing that. But what happened was, you know, I eventually moved to San Diego. I decided I was ready for a change in my life. So I packed up my car. And I thought, you know, I've got a pink slip on this car. When I get to California, I'll get a loan, I'll get a place to live, and I'll be good. And, you know, I really didn't have an understanding of you have the job to get the loan to show you that thing, you know, but I was ready to go. And so, as I tend to, I went. I was ready. And, you know, I had experienced a few blackouts already in my drinking, periods where you don't have a recollection of what took place. I mean, there's some pretty clear evidence that I went from Colorado Springs to Windsor. I remember sitting in a truck stop somewhere in between there, and I remember crying because my hitchhiker had left me. You know, I love to pick up hitchhikers. There's nobody more thankful, you know, and buy them some beers or whatever. And so I picked up this hitchhiker who said, "Why don't you let me drive?" Well, nobody drives my car but me, you know. And, you know, he needed to get away from me because who wants to die behind the wheel, you know, in a car with a drunken woman driving on snow-packed roads, you know. And so I have that memory, and then I remember stumbling up the steps to this little mini-mart kind of thing to call my girlfriend, because that's where I'm going. And I'm hanging there, and I'm aiming for the numbers on the payphone. You know, and what I remember most is that look of disgust from the people that were working there at that store at my inebriated, my total drunkenness at, you know, what am I doing out on the road kind of thing. And then I remember thinking to myself, you know, you shouldn't sleep on a waterbed when you've drank this much. But I couldn't put the two together and get off, you know, so the waterbed. And, you know, I drank till I was 27. And I had a lot of good times. I had a lot of tragic times. We all have incidences we'd rather forget and some that are funny to remember. And I got a job in L.A. And, you know, bunch of jobs, bunch of stuff. I'm here for 40 minutes and then you guys are free to go. I can't even leave now. But this is like, you know, a bunch of years packed into a short time. And this job was important to me. Jobs always were important to me because they meant I could take care of myself. And I was just fiercely independent. I wasn't going to hope that someone would get me what I needed to be okay. And then I laughed with one of my friends today. They said, "Yeah, you always brought beer or something." I would not show up at the party house empty-handed, you know, because I was taking care of myself, and that just was paramount. I would get up and drag my butt into work in the sorriest conditions because I needed to be okay, and that meant I was okay. So, you know, fast forward a bunch of years, a bunch of crazy behavior, a bunch of trying to be okay and not being okay, trying to feel like I'm doing well, trying to have fun, and the consequences are getting greater and greater. And the payoff is getting shorter, but still there. You know, I still get to learn to lip sync in public and and do other fun things. But what happened for me was that you know, I was about to lose another job, and it was a good job, and I had moved up from L.A. to Bakersfield and then up to Visalia with this same job, and I deserved to be fired, I really did, but it was a union job, and they couldn't simply get rid of me because I was a poor worker, And so, you know, I had a lot of documentation, a big thick file and all of that going on. And, you know, I wanted to be worth my salt. I wanted to be a good employee, but I simply couldn't because it was far more important to drink. And once I started drinking, I probably wouldn't go to bed till 4 or 5 in the morning. And then I'd lay there for maybe an hour, hour and a half with my heart beating real fast and thinking, my body's resting, you know. And then I would get up and have some drinks and then I'd go to work, you know. And I remember sitting there at this office in my little cubicle, in the little field of cubicles there, and I'm rocking back and forth and kind of humming to myself. I'm trying to comfort myself. I feel empty on the inside. You know? And then I would get my morning break and I would drive across 198, and where there's a little donut shop, there used to be a liquor store. And I would get a half pint or I'd get a tall boy or whatever I was going to drink, and I'd drive down to Robin and I'd drive over to Walnut and I'd drive back to Acres and into the parking lot and back into work, you know? And then lunch I had a little more time to drink. So I drank in the morning, I drank on my coffee breaks, and I just, you know, it made me feel good. Being good to myself was not driving 2 miles home from work drunk. I would stop at the little beacon there before I headed down to Lover's Lane and get myself something to drink, you know. So alcohol had become my solution. It had, it's become my life. I used to have this big beanbag chair in my living room, and I'd sit there, and all these empties all around me, you know. And I'd call my dad every now and then at 11 o'clock at night, knowing full well he went to bed at 7, you know. But I'm lonely, and I'm doing that, and he would say, "Honey, alcohol's a depressant. Can you hear that?" You know, alcohol was my solution. It was what had made me feel okay. And I kept looking to it to fulfill that role long after it stopped. So there I am at work, and I'm getting called on the carpet one more time. I've already got busted for drunk driving. I told them I was sick, which was no lie, but they had noted a police report in my personnel file of arrest in Bakersfield for drunk driving. But I'm not stupid. You know, when I get a little sober, I make dumb decisions when I'm drunk. But I had gone to the doctor that afternoon, and I had a doctor's note saying I was sick. And boy, were those union people happy. So, you know, I got a few days off, disciplinary action, and went through all that. And then one day, there I am at work, and my boss calls me into her office. And, you know, 2 years I've been getting called in there, and she's been after my butt for 2 years, and I've been dodging bullets and singing and rocking. She said, "You know, Danette," she said, "you seem reasonably smart, but here's these, you know, 7 horrific mistakes you've made. You're making our company look really bad, and you know, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know how to help you." And I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, when you're hanging on to your last rope with your fingernails and it's fraying. And I told her, I said, "You know, sometimes I drink too much." And, you know, it just felt like I was up against the wall. And I had fought with everything I had to not have to be there. And that's where I ended up, because when I drink, booze becomes of paramount importance. And, you know, that landed me in a rehab. They sent me to, it was Pine Recovery. I got sober in 1987, and at Pine Recovery, I was envisioning, you know, what my insurance would cover, and I was going to weave baskets and make moccasins, and I love crafts, I'm very handy, I need some time off work, it's way too stressful, and, you know, having to show up every day, you know. And at that's not what it's like at Pine at all. The residents do the work that make it function. They cook the meals, they clean, it's no party. And, you know, I've been there, and I remember going to the Alano Club and thinking that the same loud, angry people were saying the same stuff all the time. And somebody gave me a coffee or some water. And they kept taking us. And I remember one time going down there, and I'd been like just having a bitch of a day. And they're like, you have to go to the meeting. And I'm like, no, I can't go. You know, I'm in really bad shape. But they're like, you have to go to the meeting. And I'm like, fine, I'll go. And you guys are going to look bad sending me in this shape. So I really thought it was going to be a reflection on, you know, Pine recovery, that I was so messed up. I was really messed up, huh? And so I went, and I kept going to meetings. And I kept going to meetings, and what happened for me was I began to hear people talking about drinking the way I did, and that they found a way to live well and not do that. And I couldn't imagine why you'd want to not do that. But their lives seemed to be on track, and they were having a good time. And I was kind of forced in this situation, because you remember how important it was for me to have a job. So I'm now there to save my job. And any number of funny things happened while I lived there in this little room with eight other women and the detox station in the corner. You know, people would come in, we'd detox, and they'd be throwing up all night in a bucket and then sneak out in the morning after we'd had to listen to them all night. They didn't stay and get sober. And you know, what happened was that during that period, I had enough time to, I had enough time to get some clarity about my life. And what I realized, I call today a spiritual awakening, and that was that I wanted more for my life. I wanted more than pretending to be okay. I wanted more than trying to make the outside look good. And I heard people in here talking about how the inside felt and how that had changed, and their outsides looked fine. And I began ever so, in a small way, the process of this program. And I got a sponsor, and I didn't use her, and then I asked my counselor to be my sponsor, and I would go over there and cry about him. I was sure if I could find the right him, I would be okay. And I carried this with me into sobriety, and I'd done the same thing drinking. And, you know, we kind of did some sort of stuff, you know, just kind of wrote out some steps and everything. And mostly I think she just listened to me in my pain. And that was, at some level, useful, you know. And about this, I was about 5 years sober. I was like 2 years sober when I... Well, actually, how sober was I? I realized for me that I needed to be clean and sober. And I had done outside issues, and I adjusted my sobriety date. And that was just a bitch of a thing for me to do, because I didn't want to give up that time I didn't have. But I got clear on it that I was going to lose the progress I'd made if I wasn't honest. And it felt dishonest in here. I'm saying, yeah, I haven't drank. And it was true. I had not drank. But for me, I've got to be without mind-altering substance to be sober. And that was the route I took. And I adjusted my sobriety date and made a new beginning of sorts, and then cried for the next, you know, 4 years that I didn't have what I didn't have because I didn't have it. And... you know, when I was about 5 years sober, I was crazier than a bed bug. I wasn't drinking, but I was going to 5 different 12-step programs. I'm trying to address all the issues in my life. I'm trying to be okay. I'm trying to get the balance. I'm looking for, you know, the answer. And I got a gift from God. You know, I was ready for a teacher. And the teacher appeared, and I called someone and asked her to be my sponsor that I believed could help me with my problems with relationships, because I was having trouble there. And everything else, I'm not drinking good, you know. And I called up this woman I'd met in a different fellowship, and I said, you know, will you help me work the steps, because I'm having trouble with my relationships. And she said, how's your AA program? And I said, well, I haven't drank for 5 years. Sometimes I go to meetings. I read the book occasionally, and I haven't drank for 5 years. But where I'm really having trouble with my relationship. And she said, you know, Jeanette, I believe if you work a thorough set of steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it will affect all areas of your life. And I knew that. I said, you know, without AA, I'd be dead. I'm so glad to be sober. But listen to me, where I'm having trouble is with my relationship. Pause. And she said, Danette, I believe if you work a thorough set of steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it will affect all areas of your life. And the second time I heard it, the first time I was, you know, doing that banter thing, that thing where I've got the answer and you've got the question and I've got the answer and you've got the question, and I knew what I needed. But when I honestly asked myself if I'd worked the steps as they're laid out in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not sure I knew what they were, except from reading them on the wall, getting results off the wall. And she began taking me on a journey. And that journey consisted of opening the book and looking at that first blank page, which she suggested was about what I knew. And then we read what was in it and the contents, and we read all the little synopsis, and we went through the doctor's opinion. And at 5 years without drinking, through this process, I became convinced to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. I'd known it, kind of believed it, but conviction was a different thing. And we begin the steps. And it was that process, it was that woman knowing what she had done with the information laid out in this book, clear and simple. She called it a textbook. She said that if I followed the directions, it was like making a cake. You know, I would get the end result of a cake, you know, whereas if you don't follow the directions or do them in reverse, you know, throw it in the oven before you put in the eggs and water, you can have a pretty big mess. And she walked with me through that process of the steps. And it was a journey. It was phenomenal. It allowed a transformation to take place in me that brought me to a place of peace. I'm no longer a woman that needs to drink. At 5 years without a drink, I still needed something. I still needed something, you know, and I was looking for it. And because I kept showing up, and because when I ask God for help, He provides it, you know. My relationship with God was very rocky when I got here. I was so full of what I knew about God that I had no room for new understanding. You know, I was ready a week sober to get up here and teach a Bible lesson, you know, and I could tell you verse in scripture and where it all means and how it fits together, but I couldn't use that in my own life. And you know what happened, as I worked through the steps, It was long distance, you know. I'd met her, and I called every week to Montana, because that was the only place I guess I found somebody who was working the steps out of the book at that time. Everybody else that I had asked was, you know, giving me a little Hazelton and a little pop psychology and a little, you know, you're okay, I'm okay. I like that. So as we work through the steps and that transformation begin to take place in me, my life changed. And it happened very gradually, and I didn't like that. I like right now big explosive changes, big explosive events. I don't want, you know, little incremental progress. But what I come to see and believe is that Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me slowly what alcohol did for me quickly. And alcohol made me feel part of, and it allowed me to have friends and to fit in. And, you know, I come to rooms like this, and I know that we all have our story of what we've experienced that has brought us to this point. You know, whatever set of circumstances have brought you here tonight. I hope that you'll stay. I hope that you'll find what I found. Having the gift of desperation is a bonus. You know, if you're beat up enough to stay, because who wants to take a look at themselves and at their pride and at how they've affected other people? It takes, for me, hitting a bottom before I'm willing to do any of that stuff. It takes, for me, backed in the corner and no other way out. So, I worked with her for 8 years, and we went through the traditions, and she moved closer, and she started suggesting that I look around locally for someone to sponsor me, that the long-distance thing wasn't working so well. But I, a woman had moved to town that had what I wanted, and I thank God for the way that he brings teachers into my life, because I'm not always willing to embrace them. And what had happened was she was moving up here from Sierra Madre, and she had written to central office and asked for a contact so that when she moved to Visalia, she wouldn't be without a connection to AA, someone that was sober. And if anyone moves, I highly recommend that. If you're going to a new place, have someone you can touch base with. Have a So Patty and I had been writing back and forth for probably 4 or 5 months before she moved up to Visalia. And I loved her. We shared this connection. We talked about our beliefs about AA, what the steps had brought us, all of this. And she met me at the home group that I belong to, the Tuesday Amity group. And I walked in, and there was who I knew had to be Patty, and I was kind of like, oh, shit. You know, she was too cute. She was obviously too sophisticated. She was entirely too wealthy, and I didn't like her. You know, I'm sober. I've had this transformation, but I still have all these little defenses. And I don't want, I've got a competition thing going on, and she had me beat hands down. And I would have never, in 100 years, been able to connect with this woman if I hadn't loved her before I came here. Because that's how my prejudice works. It works against me. And we hung out a little and became friends, and I asked her to be my sponsor because she had what I wanted. She was living in a way that was gracious and dignified, and, you know, I wasn't going to be like her, but I wanted some of what she had. And she, and I was afraid to ask. I've always been afraid to ask someone to help me. I don't want to ask for help. I got the answer, I just gotta wait for it to cook up and come out. And so we worked through the steps, and we worked through the traditions, and you know, another layer of transformation took place for me in that work I did. And she asked if different areas cropped up, you know, her belief was similar to Heather's, that if you work a thorough set of steps that affects all areas of your life. But it was a little more direct. She said, why don't we take these steps and see how they apply to money, property, and prestige. And let's work through the steps with that kind of a focus. And it uncovered some stuff that I wasn't willing to see, or that I hadn't been able to see, or, you know, as you get more sober, as I got more sober, it seems like there's more that I'm willing to be aware of. And, you know, change has been ongoing. It's the constant. And, you know, and Patty moved and was blessed to be able to move over to the coastal area, and I continued using her as my sponsor and meeting with her for an hour every week. And that has been how my sponsors have helped me. For me, I can kind of slip away and I forget that there's work to be done. And I forget that that I need to continue to apply these steps in my daily life. That it's a approach to living that really works. When the going's rough, when the going's good, the steps always shed some light where it's dark for me. And we continued to work like that, and I made some discoveries that have helped me to become, I don't know, more comfortable in my skin, more, I hope, respecting of others, less pig-headed about my rightness in every situation, which those closest to me know is still challenging. You know, I still have a good idea. And, you know, I remember Patty telling me, she said, just because your idea is a teeny, weeny little bit better than someone else's doesn't mean you have to, you know, get them on the right track. And I thought, oh, you mean, it's like that part in the Big Book where it says that everyone wants to be the director and is forever trying to arrange the stage and the players to be in the right sequence. And if those things would only stay put, everybody, including me, would be extremely happy. And sometimes less is more. Sometimes less is more. So I have an in-town sponsor again. It was difficult. It's been difficult for me to move on from a thing that seems to be working. I'll hang on to it till it's, you know, at least rotting. You know, it's got to be dead a long time before I'm turning loose. And that's worked in my favor in many times. You know, hanging on to that job, hanging on to not drinking, no matter what, no matter what. You know, I got it early on, back when I was in Pine. This is what happened for me. I went home on my first half, and I was going to drink. That's all there was to it. You know, I'd been 2 weeks dry. I got my first half, and the lady that had been coming over and taking care of my aquarium had cleared out my my Jack Daniels. She'd taken my mimosas. There was no brandy. It was there. You know, old Mother Hubbard. And nothing in the cupboard. And I said to myself, I'm going to walk down to that mini mart and I'm going to get me something, you know. And I said, but you know, I think I probably should get some different clothes to wear before I go back with my hour and a half cap. You know, I got to keep my job. So I went up there and I looked around, got some new hot clothes, you know, because I was, what was it, 27? And boy, it was all about looking good, you know. And then I said, you know, maybe I should water my plants before I go to the store. And I put it off for one small task. And I realized at the end of it, it's almost like the people in AA and their shares have seeped into my head a little bit. And I'm driving back to Pine, and I'm thinking, I didn't drink. I didn't have time to drink. And that's how I would do. I'd put it off for 2 minutes. It's not that I wasn't going to, because by God, I was. But I wasn't going to do it until I finished this, until I finished that. And you know, those 3 minutes have added up, those 3 minutes at a time, have added up to 23 years and a few months for me. And it's God's grace and the fellowship and people putting out their hand and helping me when I don't know what to do next, you know. One of the reasons I love Alcoholics Anonymous is because we share our experience, strength, and hope. Nobody's preaching to me. Nobody's telling me where I'm going if I don't follow God in this certain path. And I was real afraid that was going to happen when I got here. I was real full of my teachings, you know. And there's almost no situation that somebody in the room hasn't had that can say to you, you know, when I was there, this is what I did, and this is how I got through it. It's been within the last, probably the last year, where I have been, well, I found it necessary to find a new connection with God. You know, it's like I'm floating along, I have a lot of interest, I have a lot of energy, I love to do stuff, I like to have fun, but I find it very easy to start looking around me and blaming other people for what's not right in my life. And I know it's not true, but if I don't stay close, I start believing it again, you know? And so what has happened is that I've begun a practice of prayer and meditation. And it's definitely a practice. I find that daily prayer and doing a few things that bring sanity to my life, like getting up, you know, 30 minutes before I leave the house instead of 6. And then, you know, I still need to be to work on time because I've got that job that means I'm, you know, taking care of business. And what that's done for me is lifted some of that fear of financial insecurity. It has allowed me to trust a higher power with the outcome of situations. Before, what I loved to do was set my mind loose on a problem. And I would drive to work, and a lot of the ways this would play out, I set my mind loose on the problem, and what happens is my mind starts telling me how I'm right. And putting these other people in their place and having conversations and going back and shaming them into better behavior, you know, whether it was because they didn't wash the tires on my car when I paid them to, or, you know, that I didn't get what I was due in some way. And I just don't want to be bothered with that anymore. What I hope for my life today is to live in a way that brings me joy. And what brings me joy, still some of the same things, you know. I love to get out there and make things happen. It's just who I am. And whether it's, you know, changing my landscape or redecorating the house or whatever it is I'm laying my hand to, you know, I like to do some hobbies and things, and I have a good time doing it. But the way I want to do it is like being present in the now, and that's been my focus lately, that I'm enjoying this moment, that I am here with you, not off in my head somewhere planning what tomorrow may bring or may not bring. And when I live in the moment, I find that all is well. And I don't want to borrow trouble from tomorrow. You know, some people speak and they go through the steps and are able to show how that's transformed their life. And some people hop around a lot and I don't know what I'm doing. But I think what I'd like to share is that, you know, my meditation is pretty corny. I set the timer at work. I meditate 5 days a week, Monday to Friday, on my morning break, and I set the timer. and I try to clear my mind. And then sometimes I do something different. If something pops in, I write it down, and I think, okay, God, if that's what it is, you know, let it be. And one of the other tools that's very useful to me is I have this little God box. In fact, I've got a couple. I have one at work, and I've got two at home. And when something's spinning around in my head, or sometimes even before it starts spinning, it's useful to me to take a physical action that is turning it over. And I'll just write it on a piece of paper, and I slap it in there, and I think, it's none of my business. I don't need to be in charge. And that's a new story for this girl. I'm thankful to be sober. Thank you all for listening to me. I guess we get out early tonight.